How would you like a 15% discount to my daily email, the stack of stuff, the show notes, discounts to the conference, all of that? All you need to do is text the word show to 33777. You'll get the annual subscription with a 15% discount to my daily email. You'll get the stack of stuff, the links to the show notes, discounts to the conference, and so much more. All you have to do is text the word show, S-H-O-W, to 33777. Text show to 33777.
Welcome to the Eric Erickson Show podcast, Hour 3.
My fellow Americans, welcome. It's Eric Erickson here across the United States. The phone number, 877-973-7425. Should you wish to be on the program, happy to have you. As always, you should text the word Eric, E-R-I-C-K, to 33777. If you click on that top link, you can subscribe to my show notes. And today, I actually did everything for the show notes because the person who would normally do those show notes has strep throat, which is probably code for on a bass boat somewhere. He's really sick. Normally, I like compile all the stuff I'm going to talk about, pass it off to Philip, and he writes the show. Well, he's actually pretty sick, so I did everything myself today. So it literally follows precisely the order of the show today. I mean, it always does, but he adds a bunch of other stuff too. Today, it's my show. It's also my prep. I will take your calls here in a little bit. Bear with me though, but I want to follow on. If you follow the show notes today because you texted Eric to 33777 and you subscribed, you'd see that we got to talk about the Supreme Court. It's actually a very interesting situation before the Supreme Court. Now, we got to go back into the moderately way back machine to the early 2000s. There were some big companies that got wiped out. So if you go back further to the 1980s, Ma Bell got broken up. And Ma Bell was broken up into regional Bell network. So there was South Central Bell and the Bell Co. and Midwest Telco and a bunch of other baby Bells. They were eventually over time pretty much all became AT&T again. And along the way, some companies sprung up that you've heard of called Sprint and MCI. Sprint's still around. MCI merged with a company called WorldCom. And it ended badly in financial ruin. There was nothing improper. If I can recall, there wasn't any sort of nefarious shenanigans, but it didn't go well ultimately. About the same time, there was a company called Enron. Enron was an energy company, and Enron was a very profitable company, and a lot of people bought stock in Enron, as they did MCI WorldCom. And Enron, unlike MCI WorldCom, Enron was cooking the books. Enron's accountants were in on cooking the books. And Enron ultimately collapsed, couldn't weather the financial storm like MCI WorldCom. Between the two of them, people's IRAs and 401ks and investment portfolios were devastated. And the Enron one was really about fraud. They were cooking the books. There was no way for investors to know that there were financial problems at Enron because Enron was masking the problems and were getting accountants to sign off on stuff saying it was legit when it wasn't. So the government of the United States and the Congress responded because at the time when the executives of the company signed off on financial statements, they were not criminally liable. They could be sued civilly, but they wouldn't go to jail if they were signing off on financial propriety statements when the company was lying. They became criminally liable as a way to ensure that every I was dotted and every T was crossed. The law called Sarbanes-Oxley went into effect, and it had the It was kind of an overbroad. It went too far. And in fact, it chased a lot of capital out of the United States. And there were several years there where the London Stock Exchange did more business than the New York Stock Exchange because companies, it was so burdensome and so problematic that companies left the United States. It financially had a negative impact on us. But the Supreme Court pulled back portions of the law, and Congress itself revised portions of the law so that it's still a law that holds executives criminally liable if they misrepresent the financial health of their company. It does lots of things with recording in financial transactions and disclosures of laws, but it wasn't as broad as it once was. And the Supreme Court pulled it in a little more. Well, there are provisions in Sarbanes-Oxley that say if you disrupt an official proceeding, you can be held criminally liable. Sarbanes-Oxley is a financial law. But the prosecutors of those on January 6th used Sarbanes-Oxley's language and said, well, it doesn't just apply to financial transactions. It's actually a much broader law. And I don't know whether or not they're going to be able to do it. Let me read you this from the New York Times. The law figures in two of the federal charges against Mr. Trump in his election subversion case, and more than 350 people who stormed the Capitol who have been prosecuted under it. If the Supreme Court sides with Mr. Fisher, one of the January 6th defendants, and says the statute does not cover what he's accused of having done, Mr. Trump is almost certainly to contend it doesn't apply to him. The law, signed in 2002, was prompted by accounting fraud and the destruction of documents, but the provision is written broadly. At least part of what the law meant to accomplish was to address a gap in the federal criminal code. It was a crime to persuade others to destroy records relevant to an investigation or official proceeding, but not to do so oneself. The law sought to close that gap. It did that in a two-part provision. The first part makes it a crime to corruptly alter, destroy, or conceal evidence, to frustrate official proceedings. The second part, at issue in the current case before the court, makes it a crime otherwise to corruptly obstruct, influence, or impede any official proceeding. The heart of the case is at the pivot from the first part to the second. The ordinary meaning of otherwise, prosecutors say, is in a different manner. That means, they say, that the obstruction of official proceedings need not involve the destruction of evidence. The second part, they say, is a broad catch-all applying to all sorts of conduct. Mr. Fisher's lawyers counter that the first part of the provision must inform and limit the second one to obstruction linked to the destruction of evidence. They would read otherwise, in other words, as similarly. The case is one of several affecting or involving Mr. Trump. Mr. Fisher, his case before the Supreme Court today, is accused of entering the Capitol around 3:24 p.m. on January 6, 2021, with the county of electoral ballots having been suspended after the initial assault on the Capitol. He told a superior in a text message that, quote, it might get violent. In another, he wrote that, quote, they should storm the Capitol and drag all the Democrats into the street and have a mob trial. Prosecutors say the videos showed Mr. Fisher yelling charge before pushing through the crowd, using a vulgar term to berate police officers and crashing into a line of them. Mr. Fisher's lawyer disputes some of this, but the question for the judges is legal, not factual. Does the Sarbanes-Oxley law cover the actions or not? It may in part depend on another term in the law, the use of the word corruptly. That word is disputed. In fact, the majority of the Circuit Court of Appeals couldn't agree on whether the word corruptly applied or not. In Yates versus United States, a 2015 case involving the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the Supreme Court ruled that undersized red grouper, a fish, were not tangible objects for purpose of a different provision, which is also meant to address the destruction of evidence. The other provision makes it a crime to conceal or destroy any record, document, or tangible object with the intent to impede, obstruct, or influence a federal investigation. A fisherman was sentenced to 30 days for throwing fish overboard after an official found him. On appeal, the fisherman argued that the term tangible object, read in the context of a law aimed at white-collar fraud, could not possibly apply to fish, and the Supreme Court agreed. In fact, it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg who wrote, "A fish is no doubt an object that is tangible," but added it would cut the law loose from its financial fraud moorings to hold that it encompassed any and all objects, whatever their size or significance, destroyed with obstructive intent. Elena Kagan disagreed. "A fish is, of course, a discrete thing that possesses physical form, one fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish," she wrote, channeling Antonin Scalia. Now, this is over everybody's head, I realize. And it's difficult to provide clarity on a very obtuse law. But the bottom line here is before the Supreme Court is a man who's been charged with violating a provision of Sarbanes-Oxley that was a law passed in 2002 to address financial fraud. And prosecutors used a provision of that law and applied it to the obstruction of official congressional proceedings, as opposed to, in the context of the law, official proceedings meant to determine whether or not a company had committed financial fraud. And today, the Supreme Court heard it, and they are really, really divided over it. In fact, a key case that could help the defendant is a case loathed by Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas. So the justices were actually kind of all over the place on this. And everybody left today saying this is going to be a weirdly divided Supreme Court on this case. And it's true. They are. And the divisions on this case actually help the Supreme Court because next week they're going to hear arguments in another case. And that's on whether or not Donald Trump has complete immunity from prosecution because he was president of the United States. My prediction is that the court is going to throw out Trump's argument. They're not going to tell Donald Trump you have complete immunity from prosecution. They're going to allow Donald Trump to be prosecuted for January 6th. But they may also restrain the prosecution based on the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation. They very well will rein in federal prosecutors who are taking federal financial regulations and laws and applying them to people storming Congress. It was a big, big division and divide. And there were no consensus. All of the justices seemed open to restricting Sarbanes-Oxley. Some of them seemed open to restricting it, but doing so in a way that could still prosecute the guy. I just have a hard time next week believing that when Donald Trump's lawyers show up and say he was president, he can't be prosecuted for any of this stuff. He's got immunity. I think a majority are going to laugh his lawyers out of court, particularly because of the scenario the Circuit Court of Appeals gave for which his lawyers had no answer. What if the president decided to assassinate his opponent? Would he be immune from prosecution? And Trump's lawyer in the Circuit Court of Appeals said, well, yes, unless he was impeached by Congress, then he could be prosecuted. To which another justice said, well, what if he then begins assassinating members of Congress so they can't carry out the impeachment? To which his lawyers had no response. Not a good place to be backed into with crazy hypotheticals like that. I'm more convinced that the justices may side with this January 6th defendant than that they will side with Donald Trump. But I'll tell you where the outrage comes today in this case. Is that Clarence Thomas wouldn't call it an insurrection in court today. And the libs are mad at Clarence Thomas for not calling it an insurrection. It was a riot. It was not an insurrection. But to the left, to say otherwise is heresy, because so much of it is just with the religious fervor these days. My buddy Steve Hayes from the Dispatch says this is too perfect. How do you counter stories about your septuagenarian candidate falling asleep in court? Well, just tweet a video of his somnolent octogenarian opponent asleep in a meeting. That's true. Oh, wow. We get the candidates we deserve. To the phones we go. Do I have time? Yes, Woody, I want to take your call. Welcome to the show, Woody. How are you?
Oh, fine, Eric. Love your show. Love the way you put together the eternal with the temporal.
Thank you.
And listen, I was just a little surprised. I thought of what Ronald Reagan said. I'm the government, and I'm here to help. When you started talking about TurboTax, I believe that it's Elizabeth Warren who has said we ought to have the IRS do our entire taxes for us. And I just think that there's a line there that we need to draw and let people take their personal responsibilities and not let the government stick their nose in it, because we know where it leads to over time.
Well, you would be right. I would agree with you completely. I still like George Bush's idea because, I mean, we're already doing withholdings, so the government's already getting that. They already get all the 1099s, and they already get all the W-2s and the K-1s. So it sure seems like it's less of a burden for the middle class when the government's already got their money, for the government to tell them, here's how much money we got from you, and based on all the forms we forced everyone to give us so they don't go to jail, this is what we owe you back, or what you owe us, as opposed to now you got to go pay this. Now that we've taken all the money from you, you now need to go spend $100 with a private company to fill out the form to send us to confirm that all the money we took from you is the money that you owe us. That's my problem. Yeah. I totally see your point, by the way. And I don't think the government should go the TurboTax route. They should do George Bush's plan.
Yeah.
But they're already taking all of our money from us, and now they're going to tell us we're going to throw you in jail unless you go pay this other company money. Now, you don't have to, in fairness. You can do the IRS form that is generated by monkeys flinging poo at the wall until they get something that looks like a quasi-passable form. Y'all, I had to take tax law. I actually enjoyed tax law. It actually, when you understand like the behind-the-scenes stuff, a lot of it makes more sense. Particularly when you understand how the lobbyists have carved out provisions, you're like, oh, I understand the lobbyists did this. But, it's a garbage system we have. You got to fill out a form so the government doesn't throw you in jail with the government having already mandatorily taken all your money anyway. Now, a group that's fighting for common sense reforms on this is Americans for Prosperity. Right now, though, they really want me to steer you to Bidenomics.com because the Biden administration is resurrecting for the campaign trail. Bidenomics is a term they walked away from, and now they've come back to, except they keep lying about Joe Biden's economic record and about inflation being transitory and everything else. And Americans for Prosperity's Bidenomics.com website exposes it in a way that's easy for you to understand, but also very easy to share with your friends and family. So when one of your lib friends quotes one of Biden's economic statistics, well, they're all listed right there on Bidenomics.com, and you can share the truth with your friends at Bidenomics.com, brought to you by our friends at Americans for Prosperity. It's one of the things they do to educate Americans about common sense conservatism in this country. They would love to have you on board with them. You can go to AmericansForProsperity.org to find out more, but learn about the real truth and record of Bidenomics by going to Bidenomics.com today and finding out just how bad Bidenomics is for the middle class.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Oh, wow. I'm just seeing this on social media. Someone just tweeted this. My teenage daughter just came into the kitchen and said, I'm watching this TV show. It's pretty cool. It's like a teen drama set in the past. What's it called? She says, something called Dawson's Creek. Oh, wow. I could get my corn flakes from my walker now. They've been demon. Mold. 877-973-7425. Should you wish to be on the program? I am going to go to Jim. You're going to be up next. Welcome to the show, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Eric?
Good. What's going on?
Just wondered what you thought about the Logan Act as it applies to President Trump and his dealings or his posture towards Russia. Kind of seems like he's guiding foreign policy towards Russia. I didn't think a private citizen should be involved in that.
So, yeah, the Logan Act. So here's the problem with the Logan Act is it was written in 1799, and there have only been two people in the entire history of the Republic charged under it, and both were found not guilty. So there's actually a question at this point. Yeah, the last person charged, it was in before the Civil War. So the Logan Act was, there was a Quaker, I think from Pennsylvania back in the late 1700s who tried to do their own negotiations with the French, claiming to represent the Americans. And so they passed the Logan Act. The guy's name was Logan. So they call the act, the Logan Act. What was his first name? I think it was George. But anyway, yeah, so the Logan Act, people bring it up all the time about these things, but there's a question as to whether or not it's even constitutional at this point. Trump being the leader of the Republican Party gets to, by virtue of that position, tell Republicans the policies he would stake out. It's the same thing when Bill Clinton was running in 1992 with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the like. He was very public about how he saw the future of the country and the future of our relations in the world. And the Democrats, to some degree, steered in the direction that Clinton wanted in terms of approving post-Berlin Wall treaties in the Senate. There's really nothing illegal about it, whether we like it or not. The question is, should it happen? Does it undermine the president of the United States? Things like that. But I don't know that we can really use the Logan Act for these things. I mean, remember, one of the greatest examples of someone trying to steer a foreign relations with a foreign government was one Ted Kennedy, who it turns out in 1984 went to the Soviet Union and tried to convince them to moderate their postures to help Walter Mondale get elected. Kennedy argued to the Soviets that if they would change their positions on a few key issues and their rhetoric generally, that it would undermine Ronald Reagan, cost him the election, and Walter Mondale could get elected and be in a better negotiating position to deal peaceably with the Soviets. Don't forget that that happened, folks. Ted Kennedy tried to get the Soviets to interfere in the American election in 1984. And to this day, the media makes excuses. Do you know how we know this happened? Because after the Soviet Union fell and Boris Yeltsin allowed Americans to go into the Soviet archives, we found the correspondence. There's your Logan Act violation. But, it was passed in 1799. Only two people have ever been prosecuted. The last one was in, like, the 1850s, right before the Civil War. And neither guy was convicted. So the fact that I can tell you these things about the Logan Act should tell you how often it comes up that I've had to provide the answers for it and how useless the law actually is. But now there's a separate question, and that is, should someone who's not in office but is running for office have enough sway to try to shape a political party positions? The answer historically in this country is yes, we allow candidates for office to do that. 877-973-7425. The outrage du jour. So I am not a bit guy. There are some who wish I was a bit guy. Do you know I lost it. Most program directors in America, on stations that I'm on, most program directors actually prefer it if I wouldn't take phone calls. from the audience. We limit the phone calls. We don't take everybody. There are some people who will sit on hold for 3 hours. I don't understand the person who will sit on hold for 2 hours and 45 minutes and think, oh, he's going to get to me any second now. Nope, I assure you, if held on that long, probably not going to get to you. Now, the reason some of those do that is because they insist that they have a right to be on the show, and they keep calling back when the call screener says you're not getting on, so just put them on hold. And 3 hours later, I get an email. I sat there the whole time, and you didn't take my phone call. Well, of course not, because I wasn't talking about Euclidean geometry today, and that's what you wanted to talk about. So I try not to do bits. I try not to moderate my phone calls. You know, I lost a station, though, because I didn't take enough phone calls. And the particular guy who owned this station was upset that it was the Eric Erickson show as opposed to the caller show. That station has since been sold. In any event, some people want you to do bits where, like, every day or once a week, at the same time, you do the same thing. We'll get the audience tuning in at this moment for this one thing that you do so well. Every way, I kind of freeform my show. If I did do a bit, however, I could have a daily outrage du jour. That's French for outrage of the day. Because there is one today. Oh my gosh, is there outrage today about Caitlin Clark, the Iowa basketball player, who has signed on to the WNBA. There's a joke there I can't make on radio. It will get me into trouble. I just set it off air. I can get myself in trouble, aren't I? Yes, Charlie's like, don't say it, don't say it, don't say it, don't say it. I'm not going to say it. So Caitlin Clark has signed a WNBA contract. She's the number one overall pick into the Women's National Basketball Association. In 2024, she'll be paid $76,535. In 2025, she'll be paid $78,066. In 2026, she'll be paid $85,873, and in 2027, $97,582. The spin is that she got a $338,000 contract in the WNBA. And at first, people were like, oh my gosh, she's going to make $300,000 a year out of college. That's great. No, she's going to make $76,000. And people are outraged. For perspective, she'll make more than my producer. He's sitting right here. Oh, wait. What figure is that? What figure? But, I mean, people are like, she's going into professional sports. All the men make money. Yes, the men make money because they have this thing called ratings. People watch the NBA. Nobody watches. Have you seen the WNBA? I mean, the WNBA games, they, like, let in people for free, and people still don't show up at the WNBA. So the comedian Bill Burr, don't recommend you watch him because there's a lot of – I mean, he makes Dave Chappelle look angelic when it comes to language. Bill Burr uses lots of profanity. But he has this entire bit on how feminists demand that everybody watch the WNBA, and it's clear that the feminists themselves aren't watching the WNBA, given the ratings. None of them even know the names of the teams or where they're located. I think there's one in Atlanta, near me, but nobody watches the WNBA games. It's a ratings-based business. If you can't draw a crowd to generate ticket sales, you can't make money. Now, given what Caitlin Clark did at Iowa and the attention, you know, for the first time in a decade, the women's NCAA tournament had more viewers than the men's NCAA tournament. UConn versus whatever did not get as many eyeballs as South Carolina versus Iowa. And South Carolina ultimately won an undefeated season for the female Gamecocks, which Maybe we should call them the Hens. I don't know. But nonetheless, Caitlin Clark's team, they lost. But she generated eyeballs. The Babylon Bee, shortly after this was announced that she was going to the NBA, put out a headline that said Caitlin Clark has decided to resume a private life by joining the WNBA. It's true. Apparently that Brittany Griner lady and her girlfriend, wife, partner, they're having a baby. God bless them. She's come home from Russia and got a girlfriend pregnant, and they're going to have a baby. And that's like the last time we may hear about her. She was a cause celeb because she was a Russian hostage kept in jail, but no one really knew anything about her WNBA career. And now Caitlin Clark, God bless her, listen, she's got amazing talent. I'm as a native of Louisiana, I'm a little bit peeved at the Pete Maravich comparisons, because Maravich actually was able to, they didn't have three-point throws at the time that he set his record, and he was able to accomplish it in fewer seasons than she was. There was like, oh, she's beat Pete Maravich's record. She's the best basketball player from college ever. Well, the stats don't hold up. And everybody's trying to champion female sports for equality reasons, and I get that. And people are trying to encourage girls' sports. But what's real notable is like the coach at the University of South Carolina, who's demanding more investment in women's sports, is saying she has no problem with men competing on women's teams. Because if you want eyeballs, frankly, you got to have men. I mean, I got to tell you, I'm not a LeBron James fan. I think the guy's just a little bit too arrogant. But if LeBron James wanted to play single-handedly against a WNBA team, I would tune in every day. You put LeBron James on one of those WNBA teams, I would tune in and I'd probably buy a jersey. I would be totally invested in watching LeBron James play on a women's basketball team. They put Steph Curry on there and see what happens. It'd be phenomenal spectator sport, but the WNBA by itself right now, they can't get people to tune in. That's why Caitlin Clark's not going to be making as much money as the men. And the fact that there's outrage over this is outrage by people who have clearly never watched the WNBA, because they would understand you got to have ticket sales to make money, to generate the revenue, to pay the players, and they don't do that. And if Caitlin Clark does, I bet they'll reward her in some fabulous way with some fabulous bonus. But until then, she's probably like going to disappear in some level of relevance, because people totally forget that the WNBA even exists. I mean, I cannot. You know, there was a video of a guy who was ambushing people walking past an arena where the WNBA plays and asking them if they knew that their city had a WNBA team, and half of them didn't know. And the ones who did, he asked them if they knew where the team played, and none of them knew. And this wasn't like selective. This was not an edited out where they edited out the people who knew. It was just a live, uncut reel of people passing by the arena where they played. And the overwhelming majority had no idea they even had a WNBA team. And of those who did, they had no idea they played literally right where they were standing. God bless you, ladies, for doing it. God bless you for wanting to be in the sport. Good for you for putting yourself out there and doing that. But let's just recognize that even based on the ratings, the viewership, and the performance, sex matters in sports and otherwise. I've told you about Old Glory Bank. I bank there. It's the bank for the freedom economy, for Americans who share their values of faith, family, freedom, the flag. Now they're doing something even more remarkable. So, you know, you can become a publicly traded company, and in so doing, the left buys up your stock and they use their shareholder clout and they push a lot of banks to the left. Well, Old Glory Bank, they're allowing Americans a chance to own a piece of Old Glory Bank. In the first year, they've added tens of thousands of accounts in all 50 states. They've grown deposits by over $110 million. They've got consumer accounts, business accounts, home loans, their own payment app called Old Glory Pay. It's great, by the way. It really is. And even Old Glory Cash In that gives more than 85,000 retail locations where you can deposit your cash into your Old Glory Bank. They've been really innovative in this. All the innovations, and now one more. Your chance to buy into Old Glory Bank. For complete details on Old Glory Bank's unique public-private placement opportunity, go to own.oldglorybank.com. That's own.oldglorybank.com. Accredited investors only. Owners must be an accredited investor. You can find out what that means at own.oldglorybank.com. Ownership interest is not a deposit at Old Glory Bank. It's not FDIC insured. It's not guaranteed. It may lose value. It's a unique opportunity for conservatives to buy the interest in the conservative bank and keep it conservative. Go to own.oldglorybank.com. Accredited investors only. Find out more at own.oldglorybank.com. For those of you outside the South, that's how we on and on. own.oldglorybank.com. Go check it out. Greetings. Welcome. Remember, if you are in Jacksonville, Florida listening, I'm actually here with you guys. I'm doing a live event tonight at Aroma Cigar Bar starting at 6 o'clock. Listeners are welcome to swing by. And then I guess on Thursday, I'll be in Orlando doing a Pints and Politics. You can come grab a beer with me at the Abbey at 6 o'clock there. Doing this fun rollout and hope to get everywhere. I really want to go up to Connecticut. I've never actually been to Connecticut before. I've been to New York a lot, but I've never been to Connecticut. I want to get up to... Got a couple affiliates in Connecticut want to go see and start traveling around the country. Of course, I got to get to Greenville, South Carolina. I got lots of friends up there I want to see. So excited to be doing this tour. This is an exhausting week. I try to be as responsive as possible with emails, but I don't think I'm going to be able to. I've got pretty much every minute of my day program. In fact, I wanted to see my Uncle Leif in Orlando. And I don't think I'm going to be able to see my Uncle Leif because I got like y'all should see my calendar. Like it is pre-programmed block by block by block, minute by minute by minute this week. Doing all sorts of events with advertisers, with listeners. I love to hang out with listeners. So looking forward to seeing those of you in Jacksonville tonight and to see some of you in Orlando on Thursday night. I gotta go back to the Supreme Court case because it's really fascinating. It's fascinating because the liberals in the media who watched the Supreme Court case had convinced themselves that Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas would absolutely side with the January 6th defendants. And they're really flummoxed that Alito and Thomas do not seem to have bought into the arguments of the January 6th people, at least to the extent that they otherwise would. Because the key cases that were cited by the January 6th defendants before the Supreme Court today are both cases in which Alito and Thomas dissented, and it was John Roberts who was in the majority of those cases, and Roberts has other reasons to dispute their claims. It's just very, very funny that you get these predisposed narratives in the press and then they're confronted with reality and reality blows up their narratives. Maybe stop letting narrative define reality and let reality instead shape the narrative. But of course, they wouldn't do that because Marxism requires that the narrative shape reality instead of the truth shaping reality. Talk to you guys tomorrow.